Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate. And that's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come. Bye.
right, time for another installment of DIY Housing TV. And today our topic, or jump off topic, is hair, property, chess. And we're going to discuss this in the terms of offense, family-based manufacturing. All right, so we'll be back in 2 minutes with that.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Talk to you about the air property phenomenon. I call it phenomenon because it is a phenomenon. This is attorney Vernita Williams. You know, when I first started practicing law, I had no idea what air property was. I didn't know what it meant. I found out what air property means doing community seminars. I found out that people think air property is property that grandmama or granddaddy or mama or daddy died and left and all the family members are owners. And I'm like, okay. Well, that sounds good in theory. It sounds good that Bobo and Ray Ray Nam will always have somewhere to live. But here is how this thing plays itself out. With this air property that grandmama and granddaddy had, somebody has to be responsible for the property taxes. And over time, I found that in many families, nobody is interested in continuing to pay the property taxes. Somebody has to take care of upkeep for the property. Somebody needs to have insurance on the property. And all too often, somebody who is always in between jobs is the one who wants to stay, of course, in the air property. So this air property that the community taught me about is something that has created horrible probate nightmares. Because what happens is over the years, somebody pays the property taxes, somebody puts a lot of money in repairs, and I've even seen situations where a family member who put a lot of money in heir property was very upset when the other family members who were co-owners would not deed the property over to them. So, what do you do about heir property? I have 8 suggestions. First of all, 1 or 2 people in that family need to just decide to take control. Now, be very careful about the 1 or 2 people, because if the 1 or 2 people are the most bossy people in the family that turn everybody off, then maybe that 1 or 2 people won't be the right 2. You gotta have at least 1 of those 2 people be somebody whom everybody else gets along with. The second thing is get a copy of the deed and see whose name is on the deed so you can see where to start from. The third thing is make a family tree naming all of the owners on the family tree and all of their descendants or children. You need to see how many folk you're dealing with. Now, don't leave out the folk who died, because the people who died that are on the family tree that are children of the owners, they still own their part, their estate, own whatever it is that they should be owning. The fourth thing is get the name and address and phone number for all of the descendants on that family tree that you can find. The fifth thing is, once you've gathered all this information, you have the deed, you have a family tree, and you have all the family members to the extent that you can identify them, the fifth thing is meet with a probate lawyer so you can find out how many probates you're going to have to do, because you're going to need to probate not just granddaddy or grandmama, but you're going to have to probate everybody who has an ownership interest in that property who passed away after granddaddy or grandmama, whoever the owner is, on the deed. The sixth thing that I recommend is get an estimate of how much that property is worth. You need to know, is this property worth $10,000? Is it worth $10 million? Because it may be very expensive to do all the probates you will need to do to get the property out of the deceased person's name into the name of the living heirs. The seventh thing is figure out whether you want to keep the property or whether you want to sell it. You must figure out whether you want to keep it and whether you want to sell it. And those who keep putting money into property taxes, repairs, property upkeep, cutting the grass, getting insurance, they especially need to figure out what they want to do, because you can't just go on years and years and years investing in the property with all of these other owners and expecting all the other owners to just be happy about turning over their part to you. A lot of the other owners are looking for something out of the deal, and they don't want to hear that you paid property taxes all those years. They don't really care about that. The eighth thing I recommend is to go ahead and do the probate on the property to get the property in the name of living people who can do something with it. So, if you're like the average family and you have an heir property situation, you really need to get the property from up in the air, and that's how I categorize it. If it's heir property, it's probably up in the air. So if you need to get the property from up in the air, then you need to take those 8 steps to get control of the situation and do something about it. Because guess what? Year after year after year, people who own that property are dying. And you may come to a place where there's nobody to pay the property taxes. And guess what? The worst inevitability is losing the family property because nobody paid the property taxes on this property that's up in the air. So, Take those 8 steps. You will be glad you did, and you'll have a sense of peace having taken control of what your ancestors left for you. I'm attorney Vernita Williams. Please visit my website for additional estate planning tips. The website is vcwlaw.com. That is vcwlaw.com. There you can find 25 estate planning tips to help you avoid legal nuisances and nightmares. And you can also find a checklist of 25 things you can do to set your affairs in order. Also, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, you may call me at 786-831-9483. That's 786-831-9483. Thank you so much for listening.
I was born and reared right here in Ben Hill County. Sure was. 807 West Chattahoochee Street, Fitzgerald, Georgia. It belonged to my brother. And there was no will made. He passed away. Naturally, we couldn't sell it. We couldn't do anything with it. But it was really sentimental to me.
I have been here since I was 3 years old. A very, very wealthy gentleman that had a lot of land here did a land swap with my father in the 60s. We've just had it ever since because, you know, no clear title, so we need help.
I was born here right over on Pine Street, not too far from here. My mother died in 1984, and after the will, she left 2 names on it, my name and my sister's name. With 2 people on papers, you just can't get along to fix nothing up. I feel like I've betrayed my mama and my daddy because I wasn't able to keep what they got back then, which was very hard for them to get. Because my mother did domestic work and my dad worked at a cleaner's. So they wasn't making anything to accomplish what they did. So I have it on my heart.
If anybody's letting their mother down, I think it's we in government by not providing a pathway that she can afford to rehabilitate that property before the city of Fitzgerald ever showed up saying it was a nuisance. It's referred to as air property in the H-E-I-R sense, but really we think of it as it's so up in the air who owns it.
We discovered that there was a horrible problem out there. The more we got into it, the worse we realized it was. A lot of people think that property can be bequeathed to them. Georgia law does not recognize bequeaths. It's not written down on a piece of paper and signed by the person who owns the property, then that verbal promise has no weight in law.
That person who's lived on the land all those years, who's paid the taxes, who's done her best to keep it up, finds herself ousted from the land because of the operation of law, because she did not know that as someone of low traditional wealth, that she too needed a will, that she too needed to protect this asset that to her was her wealth, but she didn't recognize it that way.
Family members often disagree on a number of things, the least of which is how to own and operate land. And so it can create a lot of problems in terms of accessing wealth that would otherwise be available for people as landowners. I think it transcends the immediate owners of the property, and it could potentially also create problems for communities as well.
The people who are holding a lot of this property, most of them don't have a whole lot of money. Most of them don't have a whole lot of education. So they've got 2 strikes against them to begin with.
If the title is cleared up, then the owner of the title, can go to the bank
can borrow money to make improvements on the property, and this house is a prime example of what can happen when it happens right, instead of sitting here and just dilapidating until we have to tear it down, and then ultimately we wind up maintaining the property long after the house is gone.
If you're able to work to clean up blighted property and to clear titles and to give people an opportunity to come in and build a home or something on that property and get a mortgage, you've transformed that community. You've lifted them up. You'll find that particularly with clearing blighted properties, the neighbors all of a sudden are out there planting flowers and adding additions to their homes and reinvesting in the neighborhood. It's an extremely positive experience.
The mission of Georgia Appleseed is to hear the voices of the poor, the children, and the marginalized, and to uncover and end the injustices that no one should have to endure. The problem of air property fits precisely in the center of that mission.
Appleseed has done some research in 4 or 5 counties. It appears somewhere on the order of 10% of the property in rural counties, based on that limited study, could be air property. Now, what that means is 10% of your potential tax base is tied up, 10% of potential investment is tied up. It's like a store having $100,000 worth of inventory, but 10% of that inventory is locked in a closet.
That equated to around $23 million fair market value. If you take that $23 million just for McIntosh County, and you multiply that times 159 counties in the state of Georgia, you end up with billions of dollars that is stranded investment that is not being used.
Appleseed, by virtue of their existence, is bringing a focus on the problem. They have gotten the first mention of air property in Georgia law ever since the existence of the state. They have an ability to bring focus to this issue from a different direction than cities and counties can.
From the very beginning of this project, DLA Piper has been at the table as a firm with individual lawyers, paralegals, other support staff willing to work with us. It's a testament to this firm backing up what it says, and we were the incredibly fortunate recipients of that kind of professionalism, that kind of ethos that obviously motivates this firm and its lawyers. One of those lawyers did stand out, and that is Shunta McBride. She was involved in every aspect of the project. And I have relied on her. Crystal Chastain Baker, the project manager, has relied upon her. The volunteers have relied upon her, and she's offered her guidance, her encouragement, and her own work to make the project as successful as it has become. We are so delighted to recognize DLA Piper and Shunta McBride as the A. Stevens Clay Good Apple Award recipients.
It feels very good to be recognized for something that you truly love doing, something that you would do even if no one else were looking. So I'm very, very honored, and I'm very grateful.
It's always an extraordinary opportunity when you can be a prototype. It can be a demonstration project. The role of the pro bono legal assistance has been the absolute key to making this thing happen.
I think Appleseed is certainly a great way to get lawyers into heaven. But what really thrills me to have the opportunity to work with this organization is that they can serve this bellwether function.
They were real nice, real courteous, professional. They have really lightened a burden on my shoulder.
It's incredible what is just being drained from the public coffers. And any real estate attorney is familiar with it. But nobody's been able to get a handle on the enormity of it until Appleseed came along.
I like that my kids knew that their grandmother and granddaddy did build a house. And that's where it was.
Okay. That was just to give you some little background on air property, not hair. Air property. And today's title is Air Property Chess, Offense, Family-Based Manufacturing. Just real quick, a lot of families, many families, when somebody passes on, they might not have the money for the property taxes or repairs. But we'll look at this two ways. A, now let's look at this as a chess game. Here are the moves that you can make before somebody passes away. That the family start a family-based business in which individuals within the family can get paid, but the business will sustain the family in all the basic expenses dealing with the house or whatever you have, you know, land or whatever. Now, some examples of this. In the Amish community, in the Mennonite community, in the Hutterite community, which is slightly different, I'll explain that momentarily. In the Amish community, typically, children go to school grades 1 through 8. That's for the academic training. And really by 8th grade, 13 years old or so, you know, everybody knows how to read, write, and count. By, you know, high school, which is 9 through 12, but they stop at grade 8, typically. And then they learn the family business or businesses. It could be, you could have an Amish family that owns a furniture making business, and they might own a furniture store to retail that stuff after they make it. Others might own some type of construction. They might, build barns, build houses, build, you know, motels, cabins, you know, whatever that family business is. It could be, you know, a bakery, restaurant. Or in the family, there might be at least two basic bread and butter businesses. On dad's side of the business, he's the one that's making carports and making barns and making tiny houses and making dog houses and, you know, making fences and things of that nature. On mother's side, you know, she's got the bakery with next to shoe fly pies and the dinner rolls and, you know, sells hot baked chicken, what have you. And they might run a flea market during the weekend or have a thrift store, you know, that's open 5 or 6 days a week. So that's, you know, you have many Amish families that are merchant-based, they're entrepreneurial-based. All right, and so when one of the parents pass on, the children who they started to, well, you know, they have the children around when they're young, but they probably start formally training them around, let's say, 10 years old, something like that. I know in Mexico, culturally speaking, children in a Mexican culture, not all but many, culturally speaking, they start working around 10. You know, so it, you know, when they, well, they got a good work ethic, okay, and they know the business that they're in. Whereas if you got somebody that is going to college at 17, 18, 19, and they want to major in business, well, you're about no less than five, the more really about 20 years, I mean, 17, 18 years too late, because as soon as, culturally speaking, as soon as, depending on the culture, the Amish, the Mennonite, the Hutterite, or in Latin America, they started learning the family business at a very young age. Well, you're just starting, and sitting in the classroom with just books, you know, academic training, you know, you read, you lecture, you might write a paper here and there, but you're not getting any hands-on experience. So give me somebody that grew up in the family business, and I'll take them over somebody who graduated from Harvard or Yale with an MBA. But having a family business, it's a very fundamental, close-range thing to do to play what I call financial offense and protect family. Now, the second chess move that you might have to make, before I even go to that, another a good example would be when you see an Asian or Arab, well, let's say a Chinese food carryout, where mom and dad sleep under the same roof. Mom and dad get up in the morning and they go to work together to the family convenience store, and it could be Asian, it could be Ethiopian, it could be Somalian, what have you. But they go to, these are people who are not, they might be naturalized citizens of the United States, but, you know, you can tell by their language, then, you know, they weren't born here. So, but they go to the family business every day together. They work the family business together every day, you know, 5 days a week together. And then they close up shop, depending on what kind of business it's in. If it's a 7-Eleven convenience store type setup, all right, they go home, and another family member comes in, maybe an uncle, niece, nephew, cousin. They come in, friend of the family, they come in, and they work the overnight shift. If they got something open like a gas station or a 7-Eleven convenience store type setup. All right. And that's how they roll with it. You know, the Patel family, and there are many, many branches of the Patel family, P-A-T-E-L, out of even India or Pakistan. Essentially, you know, a lot of them own motels, the chains of motels. Now, they're probably not, more than likely, they're not the typical ones I'm familiar with. You know, they're not any brand name motel. Maybe some of them do have some brand name motels, like a Motel 6 or Super 8 or something like that. But a lot of them, you know, when you check in and if you hang around for a day or so, you know, you'll see maybe 3 generations that live on site and help run that motel property. All right. So once again, they work together, and they keep that wealth, and then it is passed down from generation. This is what I call heir property chess and playing financial offense. All right, so if an heir passes or a relative or whatever passes and they don't have a will or whatever, to get those property taxes together and all, you know, maintenance and repairs together, you need to think of an offensive plan. In other words, what kind of business could you start with as little overhead as possible to get the expenses down and eliminate it? I've mentioned on here several times Mignon Francois. She started with $5, and the family business that she started with her grandmother's cupcake recipe was a cupcake business. It's called the Cupcake Collection. They have a location in New Orleans, Louisiana, and one in Nashville, Tennessee. But that family-based business, which was her grandmother gave her the recipe over the phone, okay, and then she had 2 daughters at the start to help her. you know. And that first week, they made a total of like $660 that first week, starting off with just $5. Her and her well, she's got seven children, so her and two of the daughters. They had some skills because Mignon never had made a cupcake before. All she did was she got the cupcake recipe from her grandmother and shared it with two of her daughters. And they turned that into a family-based business, which that was able to, it was interesting, when the family came together, okay, they were able to generate enough money in a short period of time to get the electricity cut back on, get the water cut back on, catch up the mortgage payments, plus the taxes, and get the house out of foreclosure. That's all within the family. That's what I call a financial offensive move. You're playing, you know, there's offense and there's defense. They went on offense. A lot of people, when you get, you know, when there's an heir property situation that comes up, for some reason, that a lot of people think defense, they go hire a lawyer. No, no, you need to go offense. You don't need to play defense. Because if you got offense, if you got a strong offense simultaneously is also the best defense you can have. Okay. What's today? Wednesday? All right. Tomorrow we have a guest on. He was on last week, so he'll be speaking about house hacking, exactly what house hacking is. And Friday, we have, what's the title of the podcast Friday? Addressing the elephant in the room. Addressing the elephant in the room. But that's on Friday. But tomorrow we have live in the studio, and so Troy, and he'll be speaking about house hacking, exactly what he'll be explaining to you what house hacking is, and actually it's a way of playing financial offense in a real life game of you know, chess, you know, based on what we talk about. So that's tomorrow, and let's see. Okay, we're going to open up the phone lines here in a moment, but let's go to this, because yesterday we talked about land theft. Here's a story about house hijacking.
She may not be Goldilocks, but a woman makes herself right at home in a property that doesn't belong to her.
Now, the homeowner wants this woman out of her house, but she's having a tough time giving the squatter the boot. Fox News' Taryn Asher live in Detroit with more on the intruder who just will not leave, Taryn.
Yeah, and you know what? She just came home right now, but we've been waiting to speak with her all night because the homeowner says that she unlawfully walked into the house, took ownership of this house, and has been living there and refuses to leave. She just pulled up right now, and before we get to our full story, ma'am, what do you have to say about that? Are you a squatter?
No, I'm not.
Why are you not a squatter?
I would like to park my vehicle if you don't mind.
Well, we would like to know because this woman says you moved in and you won't leave and she owns this house.
I'll show you my credentials, as you know, why I'm here.
She says that you said this was part of a program.
I have a construction lien for the repairs that I put into the house. Someone had broke into the house on July the 4th and they stripped the radiators and I made a report.
But she said that you broke into this house and you have been living here because you said that you have the right to live here.
I have a lease with her since October 9th, 2012. And then in February 2011, we had to vacate because the boiler was damaged. The only thing I took, I own Little Egypt Publishing Company. I took all my books and my writings.
All right,
but my furnitures were still left in here. One more thing. She also said that you said that this was part of a program, that you felt that anybody who can go into Detroit, take over an abandoned house, and live there.
Well, I'm an advocate for affordable housing. That's a part of my campaign as a U.S. write-in.
Did you say that to her, and do you believe that?
Well, I believe that since I met her. The first time I met her when I was running for state senate, 2010, and she was also running for political office. That was a part of my belief. I signed an oath pledging that I would fight for affordable homes.
All right, well, ma'am, maybe we can talk to you about this a little bit more in a moment. There's a lot to this story. Take a look what the homeowner had to say about this.
You can't get any houses like this anywhere in America, especially for this price.
Heidi Peterson always dreamed of living in an historical home. In May of 2010, she bought this one in Detroit's Boston Edison District for $23,000. After being away for a year, she returned home last week and realized she got way more than she bargained for.
I told her it was my house.
She says a woman was living in her house, the one who put her pictures on the mantle. Heidi learned from neighbors she'd been living there for a few months. Heidi claims the squatter changed the locks, reworked the plumbing, replaced her appliances, put a lien on the house, and even changed the curtains. And now this squatter won't leave.
She locked the door, so.
So now they are forced to sleep one room away from each other. Heidi with her one-year-old daughter.
People would find this odd that you're living with a squatter.
That's, I guess, something that happens in Detroit.
An unusual situation and, as we discovered, not your average squatter. Her name documented all over the house, missionary Tracy Elaine Blair, a write-in candidate for president.
Do you feel safe?
I don't know. I don't know what the capabilities are. We're afraid of her mindset of entitlement.
A squatter doesn't have a legal right to the property, but under the law, the homeowner cannot remove a squatter by force. In most cases, the homeowner has to file a civil action in court, prove it's their property, and evict the squatter. That's what Heidi is trying to do.
She thinks that this is a program in Detroit to take people's homes and fix them up, and then she gets to keep them.
Because Heidi spent all of her money on this house, she says she can't afford to go anywhere else. And until she can legally kick the woman out, they are forced to live under the same roof.
I thought, if the house is not safe, how can I come here with my child? There's an issue with that. But should I lose my house to a squatter because I don't have rights to my property, or should I fight to get it back?
And Heidi also claims that things have come up missing in her house, that it's certainly not the way that she left it. But, of course, you heard the woman, the supposed squatter here, and she claims that there was a lease. Heidi said there was not. We have not been able to see that, but she also says that she has the right to be able to live here if she fixes up the home. So there is clearly a lot to the story, and this is a perfect example why police don't go in when they're called and just remove someone from the house, because they don't have that proof on who actually lives in the house. And that's why, like in this case, the woman has to go to court, get an order of eviction, and prove that she owns the house, and then evict the woman that lives there. That's why there is a legal process, and it would take 30 days to get her out. So clearly there is a lot to this story. We would like to take a look at that lease, and we plan to after we send it back to you.
All right, Taryn, so we know why the police won't get involved in this kind of thing. What about attorneys? I got to believe it's very difficult for either one of them to get an attorney because they're cash-strapped in the first place, which is why they're living under the same roof.
Well, yes, Heidi told us that she can't afford an attorney. She put everything into this house, right now she can't even afford to move anywhere, let alone pay for legal fees. But she says she needs one because there's no reason why there should be a lien against the property. In fact, that lien is in that woman's name, the supposed squatter here. So a lot of this stuff happening while she was gone. She said when she returned home, there was a lot of changes to this house, stuff that she did not approve. So it sounds like it's going to be quite a legal battle, and you're right. She wishes she could afford an attorney right now. Back to you.
All right, Taryn Asher reporting to us.
Tonight we are taking action for some neighbors who are living a nightmare after squatters moved in on their block.
They've been cited, even caught stealing electricity, but somehow they're still there.
And that has our Ronnie Dahl paying them a visit. She joins us live from Detroit's East Side with more squatter drama. Ronnie.
And there is a lot of drama going on out here. Now, this is why I'm here. Take a look at the block. This is a place where the yards are tidy, the houses are nice, the kids are playing, families are being raised here. Yet some of these neighbors that have lived here for generations tell me they're being forced to live in fear after some thugs decided they wanted to live on the block. And even with the new squatter laws, getting them kicked out isn't so easy.
Hi! How are you?
Friday afternoon, I stopped by the house on Eastburn Street, introduced myself to the squatters. That's me.
Oh, okay.
That's me. I'm Ronnie.
Are the camera on?
Yeah.
We on the news right now?
Yeah, you sure are, honey. News crew or not, they don't seem to care. So we're trying to figure out what you guys are doing in this house. Did you hijack it?
Hijack it? No, ain't nobody hijacked our house.
We go back and forth.
Look, ain't nobody living here. We're just here for the moment.
You're just here for the moment. How long's that moment?
Okay.
Detroit police tell me Tanya Houston and her crew have been living here close to a year. The elderly owner moved out. The house is in transition, making it an easy target. Tanya was cited for squatting and for stealing electricity several times. I'm told she showed cops a lease, but it was fake. When I asked to see it, I got a performance.
She ain't the landlord. Why she want to see the lease?
Out of concern for the neighbor's safety, we didn't talk to them on camera. They have to live here when we leave, and these aren't nice guys.
We live in this black neighborhood. Black folk came on their own business.
Rappin' Billy Joe came down while we were talking with a neighbor, an apparent show of intimidation, which ended with him kicking her cute little dog.
Hey, I don't like dogs. I'm allergic to dogs.
Well, we don't like squatters, but you're still here.
I don't like dogs.
Detroit police have been called out here at least seven times over the past few months, including to issue that citation for squatting. First offense is a misdemeanor, but even with the new laws, getting them kicked out can be difficult simply because there's not a clear homeowner here. And without the homeowner to complain and to go to court, well, sometimes this is what happens. They end up staying, and the hardworking neighbors paying the taxes, they have to live with it. For now, we're live on the city's east side. Back to you.
Yeah, certainly a tough situation.
Now, this happened on Detroit's west side, and police are calling this a home invasion. But some people are seeing it a little differently. The victim did not want to talk on camera, but a few family members of the suspects did. Last night, the lady of this house came home to one hell of a surprise. There was one heck of a party in her pad, but she never got the invite. Three men had helped themselves to all of her gin and her Seagram's Happy Juice. And these cats went crazy. They cooked up all her food, crab legs, shrimp. They even had a bird in the oven. Can you believe it? And while they were fixing their feast, they were high as a kite on the chronic. Bold, huh? She screamed. And they ran out the house. Then the lady called the law. According to the police report, the victim says her house was a hot mess. A bunch of her stuff was stolen, including some very sentimental things. And the dudes dining at her dining room table were fellas with familiar faces. She told detectives two of them live right next door. Now, that's worse than a nosy neighbor.
Your brothers were in there?
Yeah, one of them. But sis here says it's not his fault. He was just a guest.
Somebody was squatting in that house. The guy that was in there, he was squatting already, so he was inviting people over as if he was living there.
If you're a homeowner, renting a property or whatever, you don't leave your home abandoned for 3-4 months.
Well, the woman tells Fox 2, she was there last Tuesday, and everything was intact.
This is Detroit, Michigan. This is the hungry capital of the world, and we will come in there and squat in your house if you're not home.
It was like a chill spot. Wait, what? I mean, this is, if you squat in the house, and you... Somebody invites you over to smoke some weed, you're going to go be right next door.
I don't know what you think about all this right now, but these people believe she's to blame, and she should have known better than to ever, ever leave her house alone for too long.
Stay on your property for your copper come up missing.
Now, that gentleman says he would never, ever do anything like that, but other people do. Two guys were arrested last night, but the other guy, he ran before the police got there. You know, the saddest thing about all this is you should be able to leave your house as long as you want to, and everybody should just leave it alone. By the way, that lady is looking for another place to live. I'm Andrea Isom on The Edge.
Hey, let me open up the mic and then hold, let me add some more time to the clock here. Here we go. Okay. We got more than 60 seconds left. All right. Well, anyway, many people, not all, but many people who have somebody pass away at whatever and the house is vacant and squatters take over. And the backstory on one of those clips with Heidi Peterson, who I know personally in person. And she's been on here at least twice. When we first started our first show, actually within the first 90 days of being on here, she was on. But Heidi had gone to Russia for an extended visit with her daughter, and she had purchased a house in Russia, not Russia, excuse me, in Detroit, Michigan. And in Detroit at the time, I mean, you can pick, like, buy like a really nice mini mansion at like a fireside price back when she was, I don't know if you can still do that in Detroit, but at that time she could. Anyway, but she went to Russia with her daughter for an extended visit, came back, and the squatter, who we heard on here, had moved in. And not only Detroit, but they are pros. Many squatters, not all, I mean, that's what they do. And it's very hard to get them out. Very hard to get them out. I think only one state in the union has laws on the books that specifically addresses what I call house hijacking or house jacking, which happens to be in Michigan. Now, it wasn't in effect at the time of, you know, the audio, that audio you just heard. I don't know, like I say, you look at the barometers out here, you got people who even jack up Airbnbs. You hear occasional stories about that. So in any event, but by playing financial offense chess, that basically requires you might have to pick up a new skill. You might have to learn how to build houses or make cupcakes or whatever you want that you can build up a cash flow so you can keep up with any expenses or any crisis that might pop up with that, you know, a particular property. So that's that on that. And let's see. Let's go to the phone lines here real quick. 309 area code, your mic is open.
Good morning, LA.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Yeah, can you hear me, LA?
Good morning.
Yes, I can hear you clear, yes.
Yeah, I've been definitely having some great conversations all morning. I wound up getting up this morning before 6 and started getting in on the clubhouse and having conversations. And then I wound up going into a solutions room. That's when I asked you for the link for the show. I was like, all right, let's see how many people will follow over. And there is people that's listening, and I know there's one gentleman that I'm waiting on him. He had a phone call coming in, so he's probably not on at the moment, but it could be. But I told him, you know, to let me know when he dials one. For one, he's a land specialist, and I've been working with him now for a few years. But he is, you know, just so educated. But he can find land anywhere, large tracts of land, small tracts of land. You know, I have a blind woman in Arkansas that needs a home, and I needed a piece of property, and I wasn't getting anywhere. And I wound up asking him. I was like, hey, man, I said, have you got any property in Little Rock? And I said, if not, I need something in North Little Rock. It wasn't 20 minutes. And I had a piece of property that was in North Little Rock that has everything that I need to be able to build her home. And it's not a bad price. So I sent it over to the church and said, now, can you tell me if this property is in the right area? So now I'm waiting on that response. But, you know, to see his response, that's the part I want people to understand that's listening. is if you're looking and you're wanting to do something, he's going to find you what you're looking for. You know, and when you find it, you know, I was looking for land in L.A. Well, he found me, you know, 60 acres. It's on three parcels. And one of them can be like your, you know, you can build a big, beautiful thing, three-acre piece of property, all fenced in. But then you look at, there's a 20-acre piece of property.
Los Angeles. That's in Los Angeles County?
Yeah, Los Angeles County.
Okay.
And it's all unrestricted. You know, the property is $190,000 for 20 acres. Then there's a 30-acre plot, and there's a 3-acre plot. But the 30-acre plot, I think, is a little more than 30 acres. They're all congruent together where they're, you know, they touch each other. And they are unrestricted. And it's not desert. This is beautiful land. This is beautiful, hilly. This is beautiful stuff. And you can build quite a community there. But it's whether or not we, you know, start educating people, you know, anywhere you want land, I've got somebody that can get you land. So, but we also want to understand and look at, you know, buying these auction properties. You know, 24 hours a day, there's auctions. We learned this from Angela the other day. You know, she gave us a great education of showing us what you can do with $500.
Right.
And I'm definitely excited about that. Which I'm getting a call from my mother.
Well,
that's right
Anthony County. That's a huge county. What now, what you say about your mother?
I said I'm getting a call from my mother. I know what she needs, so I'll call her back. Text her here in a few minutes. So but yes, Los Angeles County is a big county, but we wound up, you know, running into this property. And when I say, you know, to people that when you're looking for something and you find something, you don't want to wait on it if it's at the right price. You know what it costs to buy land in L.A. County. If we could buy 20 acres in L.A. County, unrestricted, that has power and water right there at the road. You just have to bring it into the property for $190,000. That's kind of a no-brainer when they're building a Target and the shopping center and all this a mile down the street. You know, so it's not like it's out in the country where there's nothing. They're actually bringing civilization to this area. But it's get it before they get there. But, yeah, I mean, I thought they want for 3 acres, the 3 acres that's fenced in, they want $80,000 for that.
Okay.
But when you're talking about, you know, what the problems that L.A. County has and every other county around there, they need to implement solutions. There is ways. It's not necessarily go throw people in the desert, but, you know, there is an opportunity right there. And I put it out to one investor, and they have been shuffling their feet. So the deal's been sitting on the table for 2 weeks now, and now there's, you know, other people that's now looking at it because there's been attention brought to the situation. So,
okay. Well, LA County is huge. Land-wise and population as well.
Oh.
Huge place.
5 million? Somewhere in there. I don't know. I'm guessing.
It's up there in the millions. Matter of fact, hold on, let me see. I'm looking. Okay, wait a minute. That's an interesting state. It's a whole lot in California. Let's see. Los Angeles County. I had it. Lost it. Los Angeles County, okay. Los Angeles County. All right, they have the population at 9,861,224 people. Is that for the whole county? Yeah, that's for the county. However, Los Angeles, the city, wait a minute, let me. Let me see if I can narrow this down. Okay, L.A. County. Okay. Greater Los Angeles. All right, the Greater Los Angeles metro area has a population of 18,500,000 people. That is massive. Okay, and let's see. The principal city of Los Angeles has a population of 3,898,747 people. It is ranked the second largest city in the United States behind New York City. But that metro area is massive. Plenty of people out there to sell to.
Yes, there is. And, you know, there's a lot of people that just like have an opportunity to have a home in that county. That's a fact. When you start talking 9 million people living in the county.
Yeah, you got some expensive housing out there. Let's see.
I mean, there's people that's just renting a room that's paying $1,000, $2,000 a month. Just renting a bedroom
in L.A. Yeah, easy. Oh, that way. Matter of fact, let me see. Los Angeles rents. Oh, Los Angeles, let's say, starter home. Let's see what those prices are.
I've seen mobile homes in L.A. I've seen mobile homes for $400,000.
That's crazy. The median starter home listing price in Los Angeles is $682,002. That is a lot for a starter home. The average renter's household income in L.A. is a little over $49,000. And they on typically 20% down. Let's see, what is the normal price of a house in Los Angeles? The median price sold as of April 2023 was $908,000. Actually, a little bit north of that.
That's the average house sold was $900,000.
Yeah,
no wonder the real estate agents in L.A. love it.
Yeah. But now, they like it, but at the same time, their cost of living is high, unless they're flying from another destination, flying in or driving in, because there are many people that work in Silicon Valley, but they live 3 hours away. And so they commute 3 hours in, put in their 8 hours, and then take 3 hours to go back home 5 days a week. Because although they work in Silicon Valley, they cannot afford to live in Silicon Valley. Matter of fact, let me look that up now. Silicon Valley. House prices, okay. Let's see. Average price of a house in Silicon Valley. Well, as of 2018, the median price of a house in Silicon Valley, that's a few years ago, was $1,180,000.
Wow.
Let's see.
You know, I just listed a piece of property yesterday, of course, because I got to leave my hometown. So I listed a piece of property. It's getting listed today, as a matter of fact. But it's 2.5 acres with a cul-de-sac that'll build 11 houses. So you can turn it into an easy $2.5 to $3 million property very easily. And that's not getting, you know, building any high dollar homes.
Uh-huh.
But you know, I list it for $115,000.
Okay. Well, Silicon, like I said, there are people. Well, it's not just in Silicon Valley, because there are people that work in Washington, D.C., or New York City, or Boston, Massachusetts. I knew a guy, he and his wife, they live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but the husband, the wife is a stay-at-home wife, but the husband, you know, Monday through Friday, he works in Boston. Now, by now, though, with people, you know, some jobs you can work remotely, but at that time, people weren't working remotely like they are today. But he worked in Boston, flew home on weekends.
Wow.
Let's see. Hey, but like, so you got a lot of, you know, you got commuters all over the place. I mean, I'm sure that people that work in Chicago, but they live in Milwaukee or some part of Indiana. You know, it all depends on a person's lifestyle and you know, their budget. So, but yeah, these larger cities, you practically have to be wealthy to, I mean, there's always a pocket in there for Section 8 people. But, and the government pays high rents for those, but that's the government paying, not the individual. So.
Right.
That's the deal on that. All right, any other announcements, Chris?
No, but I did. I was just sitting here thinking about something on what you just said a few minutes ago. The average income in L.A. County is $48,000. And the average home being sold is $900,000.
Yep.
The even if it was $648,000, if you were paying a mortgage on a $1 million home, that payment, wouldn't it be around $5,000 to $10,000 a month?
Well, let's see. Let's figure it out. Let's see. Let's go with monthly payments. Monthly payments on, I'll go with $900,000 house. Amortize for 30 years. Let's go. All right, let's see. All right. Monthly payments on a $900,000 mortgage. If you can, monthly payments on a $900,000 mortgage. If you're considering a $900,000 mortgage that has a 7% fixed interest rate, and you put down 20%, which is $180,000, the monthly mortgage payment for one 30-year mortgage, on a 30-year mortgage, is a total of $4,790.18 per month. While if you get a 15-year mortgage, the cost will be $6,471.56 per month. That's another reason why I prefer to build something. Getting a little help from my friends to build it using social capital, and you're debt free.
Exactly. And that can happen in LA. With the people.
Unless you got some real good health insurance, you get sick, you're done. And that's
you're
at
done.
7%. Yeah. That's
now,
at 7%.
Now, while you're playing with you're playing with these numbers and you're doing something, let's look at what is 48,000 divided by 52.
Okay, you say, all right, 48,000 divided by, divided by 52, that's $923.07.
Okay, now times that by 4, and I'm going to show you can't pay the mortgage on your house working for the average salary in L.A.
Yeah, that's over $3,600.
Right, and your payment's $4,600.
Right, yeah, it's $4,600. You're right.
So you already becoming homeless, and you just work 40 hours a week.
Right. You know, people don't look at that. It doesn't take long to become homeless when you're already homeless before you even get in the house.
Yeah. Every person right now, every person needs to understand something. 400 banks are going to collapse. 400. Now, when those 400 banks collapse, people are only federally insured for $100,000. If you have any more than that, you're not guaranteed to get it back.
Right.
This is every 80 years, there's been a revolution. It's either been an internal or an external one. 80 years ago, we had an external one.
Uh-huh.
80 years prior to that, we had an internal one, the Civil War. 80 years prior to that, we had the Revolutionary War, and that was an external war. We are on the 80-year mark right now to have this internal war. So if you look back at just the history of America, every 80 years, there's a transition of power. Now, why would they be picking now to have to close down 250 or 400 banks because they don't have the capital to cover $250 billion? You know,
right.
There was a law that was written that caused this. And it caused it to where the big banks could come down and they could come under the one world order and the one world currency. You know, we need to pay attention, you know, what is happening. You know, they give you a shock and awe that the bank in Silicon Valley goes under. And it was just the first of the tumble roll. But well, here we are talking about Silicon Valley, where all the money is, where all the technology is being made. And here we are, your bank can't make it. So we know for a fact that if people with money don't have it sitting in the bank, okay, and the 90% of the country has their money in the bank. Now, 90% of the country is relying on a paycheck. So 90% of the country is 90 days away from homelessness, and I don't care if you own your house or not. Because if you can't make the payment, they will take it. If you can't pay the rent, they will kick you out. And all they got to do is say, this is it today. And your whole world is going to change. So people that live by a plan know that life is not planned. Okay, life is ever evolving. Good, bad, or indifferent. It's evolving. And you either evolve with it or you start to dissolve in it.
Right.
And to me, that's kind of where we're at right now. You know, we've got a serious thing that's about to happen that if people would realize, pull their money, put it somewhere besides there, but you don't need to necessarily put it in paper because the second that private bank, that's the Fed, says that paper's no good. That paper's no good. If you want to look at history, just look at it. It's already happened. When they say money's no good, then that paper's is you can go wipe your butt with it.
Right.
And there's been so many different currencies that the United States has used since its infancy. And most of it all came from them saying either turn in your money or you're not allowed to own gold. You know, when they made it illegal to own gold, that's a problem. You know, how do we want to live, people? we live in something that we create. It's whether or not we initiate any effort to make sure that it's right. I don't know.
I've been in a lot of conversations, and I've heard a lot of things here just recently that people need to listen when others are talking, especially if you don't know what they're talking about, because that's how you get educated. But people listen, but I've been speaking words for 18 years, and I've been waiting for the human race for those words to be heard. You know, I get grayer and grayer every day, and every gray hair is from the people that I meet that scare me, because it's like scaring the life out of me. I mean, literally, I think I'm going to be white-headed in the next 5 years easily. Unless I see a change. Because for 18 years, I've watched people ignore the difference they can be and the difference that they can make, you know, to others. And, you know, I think your show, and from what people have said to me, I've got remarks about, you know, what you do on your show, even if it's a recording. It's great information. And the beautiful thing is you've got over 2,000 episodes that are recorded that people can hear. Right now, you can go back and find out all the things that as L.A. was learning, meeting people. This man's a researcher. Man, he is always bringing value to me. And I love it. He don't always unmic me. I'm just sitting back listening most, you know, a lot of time, because he has so much to pour in, right? So I listen. But also, see, he sits back and listens when others pour in because he's taking notes. I guarantee something about today he wrote a note about. Am I right, L.A.?
Yeah, I take notes all during most programs. During the program, people might hear me. If hear any, but people hear any thumping, that's typically me. Oh, and unless I mute my mic and you can't hear me do it, that's me taking notes on my phone.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, people bring up stuff that I try to look up in real time. Now, if I can find me, I'm probably have to pay for it because I'm doing the free stuff. Audio stuff where I can, you know, look up something and rip the audio. I got to find a good one that I can pay for, because I'm using the free ones, and sometimes they, you know, you can get them down and sometimes not. But, yeah, I take notes. And then a lot of times, like recently, really if you just like for last week, somebody will present a blueprint, and you know what, if you just copy that, just stick with one or two blueprints, because that's the thing about information. You can get information overload, but you only really need one or two cookie cutters, you know, to be successful at something, in my opinion. So that's why we're bringing the guy back he'll be on tomorrow, Thursday, because he had a simple, basic cookie cutter. All right. If he has a backyard, a lot of people have a backyard. If you don't have a backyard, you might have a friend who has a backyard where, you know, you can come to some kind of arrangement where you can put a tiny house back there or build one. Now, he bought his tiny houses, whereas I would prefer to build one. But, you know, it all depends on, you know, everybody's got a different situation. But and then he rents them on Airbnb. That's part of the cookie cutter. And two of them, he gets $9,000 a month. So, Just that one program, you can just, and basically that's I want to visualize that, with, you know, taking ideas, you know, building metal buildings, $1,000 frame and all that, and then visualize it, and then, you know, I think people get more traction out of it. You know, what Rep, Pastor Slade, you know, about a month ago we had him on here, and his cookie cutter was good, you know. So,
Pastor Slade had a great cookie cutter program, you know, and, yeah. And they went just on, you know, they're looking at one thing. They were looking at how can we help women, veterans, and children. And when they did their thing, and they were able to go, you know, and work through the wording that needs to be said instead of it being a house, it was a cabin. You know, the key little things to these little cookie cutter projects, you know, and then I get a phone call telling me that I got a guy that wants two Airbnbs in his backyard. And I was like, I know that man did not listen to this radio show and hear the man in Oakland and know in Jacksonville, Florida, that he wanted to have that done. But I'm thankful that he called because it gave me another perfect example that I can show him that it works. Because there's already two in a city, in a backyard, that is making $9,000 a month.
Yep. So, that, yeah, like I said, that's why we're bringing them back on tomorrow, because it's a doable plan. Like I said, you can either buy a tiny house or buy a shed and convert it into a tiny house or build a tiny house. But like I said, backyards are abundant. And like I say, you can, like I interviewed one down here, his name was Curtis Stone. Curtis Stone's a gardener, a farmer actually, not a gardener, but a farmer. And he makes a pretty good living, six-figure living. He might be up to seven figures now, planting, growing microgreens. He grows microgreens in people's, but you know, he started off with other people's backyard. That's like, so he has a pretty good business where he grows microgreens in various people's backyard, and then, you know, it doesn't take that long for hot, you know, microgreens to sprout and germinate, you know, germinate and sprout and all that, and then he sells them. He sells the microgreens to local restaurants, you know, that want fresh produce. I interviewed him about 5 years ago or so. But, you know, so there's a lot of potential in a person's backyard. So a person's, air property, if you, you know, you need the property taxes back paid, put that backyard to work. You know, maybe tiny house is not your thing. Maybe microgreens are your thing. Or, you know, it's only limited to your imagination what you can do. So, you know. But that's, you know,
I did not see or hear episode.
That's about at least 5 or 6 years ago, yeah.
What's so funny is you said that, and I instantly, you know, I had a smile on my face. I felt joy inside because you said he started out using other people's backyards because he didn't have one. And that's beautiful. I mean, especially if you wind up looking at saying, hey, you know, how could you get to know your neighborhood? Well, if you wound up putting money in their pocket and paying their bills, I'll tell you what, your neighborhood's going to like you.
They sure would.
So, you know, I just saw something from what you just said. I just learned something on how to maybe go out and engage the community, any community. But it's more finding the one person in each of those communities that don't have a problem going out and talking to others or sharing the information with the community through the neighborhood association or whichever direction that might be. But just off that one little example, you know, started my brain thinking. So I love the ingenuity of that man. That's for sure.
Right. Yeah, like you say, he might be up to seven figures now. And, you know, the person with the backyard, they're getting, because he does all the work. You know, he does all the work, or he has helpers now. They do all the work, and in return, the person whose backyard it is, they get fresh vegetables. That's how that goes and whatnot. So,
you know, that's
all right.
That kind of comes down to our dream habitat idea with the greenhouses. You know, if you had every community throughout your city, there is a piece of land somewhere in that community that a building could be built. And it could grow fish, vegetables, and mushrooms year-round, but also be like a co-op, because you're either going to eat the food or you're going to reap the benefit of someone eating the food but paying for it.
True. Chris, we got another call
is,
here.
Oh. Go ahead.
We got another call. Hold on, Chris. 773-449, your mic is open. Your mic is open.
Hi there. Hi. How are you guys?
I'm well.
Thank you. Deborah Gross said that she just joined. I don't know how she dialed the wrong number. I'll text her back, but she has, I met her through an organization that she had called Off the Alley. So.
Do you have a website?
Well, she is now Honeybee Collection, which is a different, she works with young ladies. I'm letting her know, I'll three-way her in. Honeybee Collection has like everything from intimate apparel. She does apothecary. She pretty much, she's a serial entrepreneur. So she's giving me a free detox body wrap and something else, a spa detox body wrap. And yeah, I got a lot on my mind. Hold on. I'm going to add her to the call real quick if you don't mind. Hold on. Well, I guess I couldn't get her. She'll probably call me back.
She can call in.
Yeah, her number is going to be 970-773-960.
Okay.
Yeah, she. I think she thought that maybe she can call in live, but then she didn't probably know that. I text. I said you need to just press 1 to go into the queue. So now Joe Merrill's, he's a part of Mama Evelyn's, and we're in the same network with National Black Hub University. So he is feeding the children. So that's an announcement for him. I did share with him. He was interested.
Oh,
he's finishing moving.
To call in.
Deborah?
You know what the timer, I didn't extend the timer. I thought I did because it usually gives you warnings.
Okay.
And she might not be able to get in at all now. So other than if you do a three-way call. Anyway, well.
Okay.
Tomorrow I will set it for 2 hours from the outset.
Okay.
Okay, what you were saying?
Well, Joe Merrill, he feeds the children. I thought he was going to be Taco Tuesday. You know, yesterday was my birthday, so I'm celebrating all month for my birthday.
Okay.
Thank you. And I was looking for tacos yesterday.
Right.
Pardon me?
Okay. You're a Taurus, right?
I am.
Taurus? Okay.
Mama Evelyn, her birthday
I'm
was...
Doing.
My call is breaking up terribly. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, yeah. The audio
Pleasant Stevens had a birthday. Pleasant had a birthday last week.
Okay. Yeah, I'm...
All these mates.
Okay, yeah. Now, Mama Evelyn's birthday was the day before mine, on the 8th. Oh, yeah, we got a lot of late birthdays.
I think May's that was my favorite month.
Oh yeah. And your birthday is when again?
May 24th, Gemini.
24th. Okay, I'm filling in my calendar because I got to keep up with it. My uncle's birthday is the day of the event for the investors event. So certainly, Chris, hello. You are interested in attending June 23rd, Friday, June 23rd at the Grand Ballroom. And it's an exclusive event set aside for investors. So the tickets start at $75. Two people can get in for $100. Because on the flyer it says couple, but two people, that's the rate that we're giving for that. It's a fundraiser for Star City. So my music producer is building Star City in Liberia. And generally the information is to those who attend. There are some things that he wants to come back and speak on the show about to share, you know, with the public. But he wants the investors to get in first and focus on those who are going to help to build a Star City. So he's already invested. He shut down his taxi service on the north side of Chicago to focus on this. And that's WF Doc, Winnefubu's
You still there? Well, I can't hear anything. Hello? Chris, you there? Oh. Hello. Okay, I can't hear anybody.
Oh, yeah, Chris is here.
I
see. I was just...
Okay, Reeve, are you there? Looks like she dropped off. And you know what, the timer ran out, so I can't get any new people in. So what we're going to do, I'll just set the timer for tomorrow's show for 2 hours from the get-go.
Yeah.
Yeah, because once... Oh, wait a minute. Okay, well, what we'll do is... we'll conclude today, and let me see. And we'll be back tomorrow.